This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib. Coming up at this hour on Africa News Tonight,
a senior UN official warns the suppression of basic rights in the Democratic Republic of Congo will worsen tensions and lead to more violence and insecurity. UN Assistant Secretary General for Human Rights Andrew Gilmore has reported to the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva on his recent fact-finding mission.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from Geneva. Details coming up.
Also, Zimbabwe police use water cannons and tear gas to disperse demonstrators, and we'll have a report on what's being done about Africa's brain drain.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, police in Zimbabwe used water cannons and tear gas today to disperse demonstrators. They were protesting against the country's new currency. The government says the bond notes should ease cash shortages. However, economists have warned bond notes will quickly lose their value and unleash hyperinflation. Sebastian Mofu reports from Harare.
These are demonstrators, most of them young, protesting against the introduction of bond notes this week by President Robert Mugabe's government. The protesters chant songs denouncing the new currency, which they say will worsen the country's economic problems. The demonstrators scattered when police targeted them with water cannons and tear gas. Police refused to comment, but activists Maureen Kademaunga believes the use of force will not silence Zimbabweans.
The economy is not going to change because people have been clamped down or have been harassed. The political strategy of ZANU-PF is not going to change. And so it means that at some point again, people will still start to say, enough is enough. We are sick and tired of being sick and tired. So we'll go back to the July era where Ivan was leading as the voice of discontent.
Ivan Mawarire led a series of protests in July before he fled Zimbabwe, fearing for his life. He had been protesting the government's failure to respect human rights and its efforts to prop up the country's ailing economy. After he fled Zimbabwe, a few more protests were held before the police imposed a ban on demonstrations in September. Wednesday's demonstration was the first since then, as police kept extending the protest ban. The protesters want Zimbabwe to continue relying on foreign currencies, mainly the US dollar and South African rand, which has been the case since 2009 when the Southern African country abandoned its own worthless money. The government says the new bond notes, which are officially equal to the US dollar, will ease a chronic shortage of hard cash. But economists have warned that the bond notes are not backed by any government reserves and are likely to lose value and plunge Zimbabwe back into the hyperinflation it experienced in 2008. Inflation at the time reached an annual rate of more than 200 million% before the government stopped counting. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
A senior UN official warns that the suppression of basic rights in the Democratic Republic of Congo will worsen tensions and lead to more violence and insecurity. UN Assistant Secretary General for Human Rights Andrew Gilmore has reported to the Human Rights Council in Geneva on his recent fact-finding mission. Lisa Schlein has more on the story.
Joseph Kabila's second and last term as president of Democratic Republic of Congo comes to an end on December 19th. A court has ruled that he could stay in power if elections were not held in November to determine his successor. UN Assistant Secretary General for Human Rights Andrew Gilmore says during his visit last week to DRC, he witnessed profound and widespread concern there may be mass demonstrations in many parts of the country if Kabila does not relinquish power.
These may be met in a similar fashion to those in September, in which case we could see a truly terrible escalation. So this is why confidence-building measures need to be implemented now to head off that scenario.
Dozens of people were killed during 2 days of riots in the capital, Kinshasa, in mid-September. Gilmore says he is deeply concerned by the clampdown on fundamental freedoms by the authorities.
A ban on all public demonstrations by opposition parties or civil society is now in effect throughout most of the country. But this doesn't seem to apply to the ruling majority, whose gatherings continue to take place. During my visit to the country, I underlined to the Congolese authorities that there can be no credible and peaceful electoral process without respect for fundamental freedoms.
Gilmore says restrictions on the media have increased. He says at least 7 journalists have been arrested, 2 newspapers closed, and 1 radio station discontinued since September. He says various DRC authorities delegitimize and denigrate civil society organizations, branding them and dismissing the demonstrators against the government as thugs, rapists, and drug addicts. He says he rejected their assertion the United Nations is in the pocket of the opposition. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The Gambia holds presidential elections tomorrow. Incumbent leader Yahya Jammeh is seeking re-election. He's been in power for the last 22 years. Nearly 900,000 Gambians are eligible to cast ballots. A coalition of opposition parties is challenging Jammeh, but critics are already casting doubt on whether the vote will be free and fair.
The ashes of late Cuban leader Fidel Castro began a 3-day procession across the island nation today. Castro died Friday night at the age of 90. His body was cremated as Cuba began a 9-day period of mourning. Castro was celebrated by some as a champion of the poor and harshly criticized by others as a tyrant who wrecked the country's economy and violated human rights. Memorial service began Monday in the capital and in the eastern city of Santiago de Cuba, where Castro started the Cuban Revolution in 1953. The procession of his ashes is moving east from Havana, following in reverse the route Castro and his rebel fighters took as they advanced before taking power in January 1959.
For decades, government officials in many developing countries have complained of a brain drain. That's when promising young people leave their home countries to study abroad and then choose to stay abroad rather than return home. Critics say that choice deprives the home countries of the foreign education and expertise the students have gained. However, some economists say there can be an upside for a country when large numbers of the best and brightest decide to emigrate. VOA's Adam Phillips reports from New York.
At first glance, Ghana-born Yao Nyarko, a tenured economics professor at New York University, seems like a textbook example of brain drain. In 1982, he left Ghana for Cornell University in the U.S., where he received his Ph.D. 4 years later. He then settled in the U.S. Like many Africans who've been educated abroad and stayed, Nyarko has sometimes been accused of selfishness and worse. He rejects those criticisms.
When people talk about the brain drain, they're talking about the fact that, for example, doctors trained abroad, instead of going back to Africa immediately, they stay in the United States. And so some people have the mistaken view that if only we could get all these doctors who are in New York, London, Canada, etc., back to Africa, our healthcare system would have been solved.
Nyarko has also been told by university leaders and department heads in Ghana that they cannot staff their classes properly because of the number of qualified professors who have chosen to stay abroad. He remains skeptical.
They have to say that. I mean, if you're running a university and you're not able to staff some of your departments, you need some excuse for that, right? And you deflect it. Maybe the issue is just that the resources aren't there to pay for professors to be in the universities. And if that's addressed, there'll be a lot of change.
Still, there are good reasons why governments want their students to return home after studying abroad, says Laura Perna. She's a higher education professor at the University of Pennsylvania who has studied the brain drain phenomenon.
One certainly is in terms of the development of investments that are made in an individual's education, on-the-job training, health, all with an eye towards being a more productive worker.
Government scholarship programs to study abroad vary in stringency. Some offer funds with no requirements other than to learn. There is no mandate to return home. But Professor Perna says that the government programs she researched in Kazakhstan, for example, are far more regulated.
So students who participate in that program, they have to put up collateral to offset in case they don't come back. It helps ensure that Kazakhstan's local economy benefits from the knowledge that's acquired abroad so that they can bring back into the country knowledge that is new and can help the country expand its economy and develop different sets of skills.
But Perna also cautions that highly regulated study abroad programs do have potential downsides.
There may be some folks who are studying abroad who opt out and they just go ahead and leave the country anyhow. And if there's not a good fit in terms of the employment opportunities that are available, I think there is an argument to be made about how that individual may be more productive and make greater contributions, letting the market forces work.
Funds sent home from abroad, called remittances, are another reason why Yao Narko and other economists say it can be good for students who succeed abroad to stay abroad. In both Nigeria and Ghana, for example, remittances make up over 10% of the value of all goods and services their economies produce. That's more than those countries receive in foreign aid.
These are big numbers, okay? They affect the foreign exchange the government has. The other aspect of it is that usually these monies go to very poor areas. So in my particular case, I look after a large number of people back home, some of the poorest members of my village. I give them essentially monthly paychecks.
New York University economist Yao Nyorko says there is abundant middle ground for those who want to stay loyal while staying abroad. For example, many educated African academics return home as guest professors or start institutes. Doctors often start clinics. Lawyers and policy experts frequently advise business leaders or policymakers. These and other efforts can make life better in the homelands left behind. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Hayes Wuhib, 18 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Zimbabwe police use water cannons and tear gas to disperse protesters. And the UN warns of growing rights abuses in the DRC. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
France's southwestern city of Bordeaux is best known as a global wine capital, but it was once France's second largest slave trading port. Unlike in some other former slave trading hubs, there is no massive memorial marking this bleak history. The city has deemed it too costly, but amid rising fears of racism and xenophobia across Europe, Lisa Bryant reports on a man with a mission to shed more light on the past.
It's a favorite destination for cruise boats and wine connoisseurs, but Carfa Diallo is more interested in another side of Bordeaux as one of Europe's busiest slave trading hubs. From the 17th to the 19th century, this city dispatched hundreds of ships that transported 130,000 slaves from Africa to the Americas. They returned laden with cotton, tobacco, sugar, and rum. The city partly built its wealth on the slave trade.
Here we are at Place de la Bourse. It was among the most beautiful squares in France. In the 18th century, Bordeaux was richer than the French kingdom.
Diallo from Senegal heads an association that raises awareness and offers tours of Baldo's slave trading past, a past he believes the city has not fully come to terms with.
The image of wine is very hard to reconcile with the image of slavery. That is why the town was very late in giving history the place it merited in public spaces and schools.
À la fois sur l'espace public, mais aussi dans les établissements.
The few markers of this past are small and hard to find. And Diallo says there are more than a dozen Baldo streets named after prominent slave traders. Many residents have only a patchy knowledge of the city's role in the slave trade.
Yes, I know about it because we study it in history class, but I don't know a lot of things about it.
Baldo's city government now agrees more should be done at a time when the anti-immigrant far right is surging in France. It set up a commission to study the question.
Il faut plus que jamais se battre pour défendre les droits fondamentaux et l'égalité entre
tous. We have to fight more than ever to defend fundamental rights and equality. But it's not about guilt or repentance. Bordeaux citizens are not responsible for what their ancestors did.
D'abord, on n'a pas la responsabilité de ce qu'ont fait nos ancêtres.
Diallo believes education is the answer to confronting racism, past and present. The more we understand, he says, the less we hate. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Bordeaux, France.
The World Health Organization is continuing to assess the risks and benefits of the first vaccine developed to prevent dengue fever. Researchers have continued to refine their understanding of the vaccine, its strength, and its very real weakness. VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
The new report, spearheaded by the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, concludes that the world's first dengue vaccine could prevent 1 in 5 hospitalizations in regions where there's a high burden of disease. It says the vaccine, called Dengvaxia, could reduce the incidence of dengue by 6 to 25% in areas with high infection rates. The authors of the study, commissioned by the WHO, also found the vaccine could be cost-effective if the price is kept competitively low. But in places where the disease is relatively uncommon, affecting 10% of the population or less, Dengvaxia could cause severe illness and hospitalization in unexposed individuals. The researchers used mathematical models to reach their conclusions, with data from human trials of Dengvaxia involving some 30,000 people around the world. The London School's Stefan Flasche is co-author of the study published in PLOS Medicine. He says, given the risks associated with the vaccine, careful consideration has to be given to rolling it out in certain areas.
Well, having said that, it will be important to have good surveillance, like with every new vaccine, on the actual impact on a population level. But unless there's something surprising coming out of that surveillance, I think that's as good as it's going to get with this particular vaccine.
Approximately half of the world's population is at risk for contracting dengue, a mosquito-borne illness that can cause high fever, joint pain, bleeding, and potentially death by dengue shock syndrome. A person can potentially be infected by 4 different strains of the virus and can be infected more than once. A second infection is generally the worst, so Dengvaxia has turned out to be a double-edged sword. In people whose first infection caused relatively mild symptoms like fever, the vaccine may prevent a serious second infection. But in those who've never been infected and are vaccinated, as would be the case in low-burden countries, the vaccine can act like a silent first infection, making individuals very sick should they actually become infected with dengue, according to Flasche.
So it's now up to, well, the global health community and to put decision makers on a local level to identify those areas where we can use that vaccine until we have better means of prevention of dengue.
Flasha says the risk of severe illness in some people is not a reason not to use the vaccine if it's applied carefully. An estimated 400 million people are infected every year with dengue fever in tropical countries, with 2 million developing a severe hemorrhagic form of the disease. So prevention of dengue, where possible, is desirable. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
Buckingham Palace in London, the main residence of Queen Elizabeth, is in desperate need of renovation. The work will cost hundreds of millions of dollars, and the government plans to use taxpayer money. That decision has triggered an angry response from critics who say the monarchy should pay its own bills at a time of national austerity, as Henry Ridgewell reports from the British capital.
The daily changing of the guard at Buckingham Palace draws thousands of tourists who scramble and strain to get the best photograph of the iconic building and maybe even a glimpse of Queen Elizabeth herself. From the outside, the roughly 300-year-old palace looks fit for the world's longest-serving monarch. But behind the facade, palace officials say it is falling apart. The boilers are more than 30 years old, and the estimated 160 kilometres of electric cables were installed in the 1960s. The pipework is made of lead and cast iron. All of it needs replacing at an estimated cost of around $500 million. The British government has approved the use of public money, but many lawmakers, like the Scottish National Party's Paul Monaghan, question why the people should pay.
Estimates suggest that the total net value of the monarchy is about $84 billion. The personal wealth of the Queen is about $650 million. So I think it should be the monarchy, not the people.
The government argues the upkeep of Buckingham Palace is vital to Britain itself. Visiting heads of state are usually given a full ceremonial welcome here by the Queen. Earlier this month, she hosted Colombia's President Juan Manuel Santos. Buckingham Palace also draws hundreds of thousands of tourists. Many visitors told VOA they were surprised to hear of the problems at the palace.
Given austerity measures going throughout the country, I would say that putting that on taxpayers and the people is tough.
I feel it should definitely come from both sides. As far as the government paying it, I feel in return it gets a lot. Tourists are going to come and it's something that tourists are always going to want to come and see.
The work will be done in stages, so the Queen will not have to move out. And with 775 rooms, there should be somewhere for her to escape the construction noise. Officials say if the planned work goes ahead, the palace won't need another renovation until 2067. By that time, Prince William, second in line to the throne, would be 85 years old. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis, and thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next on Straight Talk Africa, Fidel Castro ruled Cuba for 47 years, leaving an imprint on almost every major revolutionary effort in Africa after 1959. Join us for an in-depth look at Castro's impact on Africa. That's right here on Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.
Hello, Africa. This is James Barty, host of Daybreak Africa, inviting you to join me every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our listener mail segment by sending your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. Start your day with Daybreak Africa every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.